I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to explore the fascinating and controversial life and legacy of gay journalist Randy Schultz, the author of And the Band Played On and Conduct Unbecoming. Joining me will be Andrew Stoner, the author of a new book, The Journalist of Castro Street, The Life of Randy Schultz. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We've got a good one for you today. We're going to be talking about the life and legacy of the late Randy Schultz, who was, if not the first openly gay journalist in mainstream media in the United States, one of the first. He was also the author of the books And the Band Played On and Conduct Unbecoming, as well as a well-regarded biography of Harvey Milk. If you want to join this conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guest is a veteran of the program, Andrew Stoner. He is the author, among many other hats that he wears, he is the author of the brand new book, not even officially released yet, right?
It's out now.
Yeah. It is out now? Okay. The author of a new book, The Journalist of Castro Street, The Life of Randy Schultz. Andy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here in Indianapolis.
And before I get started, I have to do a standard disclosure. Andy is an alum of the same journalism school I am the director of right now. I don't want anybody, I don't like to withhold things from the audience. So well, that's out of the way. And it's odd because, and I should say at the top of this, what I just told you off the air, I enjoyed the book a great deal.
Well, thank
I enjoyed
you.
Reading it. But it occurred to me, Randy Schultz is a figure of tremendous importance and still feels current to those of us of a certain vintage, but among other things, what I put down, what I realized when I finished reading the book was, oh, wow, it's been a quarter century since he died. So for those who have, who have come along since then or come to awareness since then, I'm going to ask you first to talk a bit about who Randy Schultz was.
Well, Randy was a Midwestern kid. He grew up in Aurora, Illinois, and shortly after graduating high school in 1969, headed out to Oregon. Wanted to be a hippie and part of the peace movement out there, and eventually enrolled at the University of Oregon and became a journalism major. What's extraordinary about him in this period, he's openly gay throughout this period. In 1969, 1970, he's running for student body president at Oregon, on a theme of come out for Schultz. He didn't win, but those of us who are old enough to remember, that's pretty extraordinary to be out at that period of time. And was very convinced journalism could change the world, could change how people viewed gay people, was convinced that if just more information and the right kind of information could get to people, that understanding would flow from that. And I think he pursued his journalism from that direction. But at times grew frustrated that the reality wasn't always so simple. But one of his journalism professors at Oregon told me that he worried a lot about his ability to get a job after college because he was so openly gay. And to be a gay person in a newsroom was really pretty unheard of. When I joined the newsroom at the South Bend Tribune in the 80s, there was no such thing. You know, it was people smoked at their desks, and it was still a pretty male.
They still had bottles in their desks.
It was a very fraternal, male-dominated culture still, and I think an openly gay person would have been quite a shock to the system of most newsrooms in America. And as a result, Randy struggled to find work in mainstream journalism. So
yeah, he was close to 30 by the time he finally landed at the San Francisco Chronicle.
That's right. And they hired him as a city side reporter, city beat reporter. So he was told, you know, you could pursue stories in the gay community, which is at that point is really flourishing in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But interesting, a lot of people miss, he did a lot of regular reporting. He was their city desk editor for the Loma Prieta earthquake mm-hmm. that struck San Francisco in 1989. And so he did a lot of regular reporting, too. But through his reporting is when he started getting, he had covered the election of Harvey Milk, the city board of supervisors, mm-hmm. and his assassination, along with the mayor, George Moscone. And so he was there for a really critical period in San Francisco history.
So what drew you, because you've done previous books, but they by and large have all been Indiana themed, even mm-hmm. though you're a professor in California, journalism professor in California now. You are a Hoosier native, so the interest in Indiana is inherent. What drew you to this story, particularly as something that you had a pretty successful track record with the books you'd done on Indiana? Why did you decide this would be the one you'd want to break through on?
Well, this was my dissertation topic. I should mention, by the way, that we've taken it pretty far away from where it started. But I always identified a lot with Randy Shields. I think I remember sitting down with one of my journalism professors my senior year of college and asking him if the fact that I was gay was going to hold me back. I wasn't openly gay, but I was always very concerned somebody would discover that and I'd lose my job as a reporter and other jobs subsequent to that I did in public relations. So I related to his openness and his courage just to be himself and his pursuit of what he was interested in. And when he died of AIDS, I was in graduate school for my master's degree, and I was just floored. I didn't know that he had AIDS. You know, he was the AIDS expert, and mm-hmm. that's a big story. The AIDS expert has died of that disease. I was really floored at the time in 1994, and as I write in the book, AIDS was still a very distant thing to me. I thought that's something that people on the coasts are dealing with, not here in the heartland. Mm-hmm. And I had some surprises coming. I had lost several friends in the subsequent years that followed. In order, actually, through 94 and 96, I lost some close friends to HIV and AIDS. And so I thought, I really need to do something with this someday if somebody else doesn't do it, and mm-hmm. nobody's beat me to it. So,
why do you think it took so long? For people to, because admittedly, it was a relatively short, he died before he turned 43, and his career as a national public figure really was less than a decade, but still, while he was hot, there probably were very few journalists who were hotter in this country.
Right. As he said, at the time, he could pretty much do anything he wanted in journalism. And in the month he died, 60 Minutes did a profile of him, which was very rare that they would profile a journalist. But I think that because there was controversy and quite a bit of criticism of some of Shields' research and some of his work posthumously undertaken, that I think a lot of people were willing to set him aside. And even I was mentioning to you, some people still view him as a controversial figure mm-hmm. and somebody that isn't necessarily representative of the gay community. Although there's the other side of the coin where there were 20 people installed in the Castro District's LGBT Walk of Fame, and he's one of the first 20 people listed there among a lot of very famous figures. So I think it's a mixed legacy, and I thought it was worth one exploring. And I have tried to do that in terms of a balancing act, to look at both the criticism but also the praise and to try to come to a reconciliation of where we can place him.
Well, and that's one of the things I think really works about your book is that it isn't a narrow focus just on a human being, where in parts it doesn't, you jump around in the chronology and all of that to put things into some kind of context. And I mean this in the best sort of way. There are times in the book where Shields almost becomes this Zelig-like character who is showing up at these major events or these major turning points in modern American history. Probably at this point, we ought to talk a little bit about how he became such a controversial and divisive figure, because you're right, people still do have really strong feelings about him on both sides of the question.
Well, and this gets to the core of what my dissertation tried to explore was, what is Randy's journalistic role? Was he playing the traditional Democratic Thomas Dewey role of I go out and reflect the world to my readers and let them decide from what I've able to gather? Or is it more of an advocacy role or an agenda-setting position, like Walter Lippmann's suggestion was that the media are social elites that interpret the world to us? And I think it's really more of the second. He really did believe that what he had to share were facts and information, and that could change the world. And I think he at times struggled with that line between objectivity and advocacy, certainly on the issue of the closure of the bathhouses in San Francisco in 1984. And also just the whole questioning of what the gay liberation movement should mean, that it should move beyond just a sexual liberation and more into a social, political, and economic revolution. And I think that you see him not only stepping over the line of objectivity, but really obliterating it at times. And but it may have been difficult to not do it any other way, because you're talking about a movement that was near and dear to his own existence, you know, in terms of in his lifetime, you could be fired for being gay. You had no marriage rights. You had just a whole number. He in college, in the days he was in college, his sexual expression was illegal, could have caused him to be arrested. So it's a dramatic transformation going on right at the same time.
If you are just joining us, we are talking today on No Limits about the life and legacy of Randy Schultz, the author of And the Band Played On and Conduct Unbecoming. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So in doing this, because it sounds like working on this book, then admittedly you did other things in between, but was a product of more than 20 years. How did your thinking about Schultz change over that time?
I would say I became more sympathetic, of course, but I also began to see more of the sides of him that weren't as favorable or weren't as complimentary. And that came from, I just thought, I can't do just this praiseworthy tome that just looks at all the positives. I had to also talk to people who were critical, who gave an analysis of him that was less than favorable. And so I sought those people out as well. And I have to say, I struggled most with his personal life in terms of his issues with drug and alcohol addiction, and also issues of alleged child abuse when he was younger that was more difficult for me to work my way through. But his family was cooperative with me and wanted to tell the story, but tell it in a straightforward, honest way and not some papered over view that would make him appear to be something he wasn't.
What was the thing that surprised you the most in the research?
I think the way that the patient zero matter was handled, I think, is really the most problematic thing that's in there. And it's still...
Probably ought to give some context on
that. Yeah, that's the man who allegedly brought AIDS to America, which has been a debunked theory now. But it was at the centerpiece of And the Band Played On. And it's something that has really kind of damaged Schultz's reputation. And he wasn't around since 94, of course, to reconcile or correct the errors there. And that was surprising to me, the way that was exploited, and that his name is tied to that forever, unfortunately.
Yeah, his argument in the book is that you advance is that it's really a relatively minor piece of the overall story he was trying to tell, and that you know, the focus on it became more a matter of publicizing the book itself, almost a marketing decision, What do you think of that?
I think that's true, and he said that, you know, the story, it turns on bigger issues than just the one, whether we can track down a person being responsible for bringing a virus to an entire continent.
Was that the most difficult part of the story to explore for you? Because it is, it remains controversial to this day.
It is. I'm uncomfortable not being able to ask Randy about it, to not be sit down and say, what happened here? Why did you go ahead and let the publicists push the book in the way that you did? If you, in fact, misinterpreted the CDC study the way that it suggested, how did that happen, given your record as being such a really tight, tough researcher and guy who double-checked everything? So I would love to have asked him about that.
And we will talk more about that on the other side of the break. We're talking with Andrew Stoner, who is the author of a new book, The Journalist of Castro Street, The Life of Randy Schultz, today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email or reach out on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Andrew Stoner, who is the author of a brand new book, The Journalist of Castro Street, The Life of Randy Schultz. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So before we went to the break, we went to the single controversy that has probably most damaged Schultz's reputation through the years. The national focus on patient zero, you know, a flight attendant from Canada who was supposedly, I think in the words of one of the newspaper stories, the typhoid Mary of the HIV AIDS epidemic that turned out not to be right at all. And this is one of the places where I think you tell the story very, very skillfully in the book, because it is, you're right, you didn't have a chance. You said before the break you really would have liked to have talked to Randy Schultz himself about it. You walk through the events there, and we'd mentioned Schultz's defense, saying that, you know, it was a marketing decision, da-da-da. On the other hand, there also is a possibility that he just sort of agreed to it, because that it becomes clear that was about the only way that, at least initially, the book was going to get any attention, any of the attention he craved. And he was a tremendously ambitious guy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he would go anywhere, was on Nightline frequently, Larry King, all the big shows of that era. And his publicist told me that, and his editor told me that they talked him into the approach of promoting Patient Zero as kind of the hook, or the hook that the story of the whole book would hang on. But you know, Randy was willing to go along with that because I think he had, like a lot of people, ambition and desire, and you know, he had a big ego. He used to refer to his birthday as Schultzmas, you know, Merry Schultzmas to everybody. He had a high opinion of himself. He was frustrated early in his career by other people moving ahead of him because they weren't, you know, as out as he was, for example. So I think some of the anger would come through there. But my sense is that he went along because he knew it was the only way that book was ever going to go anywhere. The New York Times had told them directly, we're not going to review it. It's not really our cup of tea. The story's not done in terms of, we don't know where AIDS is going. And so when once they released this idea about Patient Zero and promoted it with a press kit, even about Gaetan Dugas, who was the flight attendant we're discussing, who died in 84, you know, the media just took off from there. And the headline of the New York Post was, "The Man Who Gave Us AIDS." Star Magazine ran a headline that says, "The Monster Who Gave Us AIDS." So We've known now since 2016, University of Arizona researchers have isolated the particular virus, the human immunodeficiency virus that Dugas was carrying, and it was first introduced to the United States probably in 1970 when Dugas was just a little boy in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. And so there would have been no, he didn't bring AIDS to America.
It was already here.
Right. Yeah. And I think that part of Dugas' trouble was he was very cooperative with CDC investigators, shared his black book, and the day before we had phones, everybody had a black book, and he kept good records of all his friends in all these different places. And he was at the center of a CDC study that found that he was connected to 40 of the first 248 cases of people with AIDS in this Los Angeles study. And that's where really the problem starts. They list him as patient O for outside Indianapolis, or outside Los Angeles, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And that gets interpreted as patient zero, that he's at center of this whole big cluster of 248 cases. And that's not a very accurate reading of that study, because if you move that center left or right or up or down, you could say that about anybody in that cluster study. The CDC happened to know a lot about Gaetan Dugas because he cooperated with the investigators. I've interviewed Dr. William Darrow and others who did that cluster study and said that he was very helpful, but he didn't understand, because he had Kaposi sarcoma skin cancer, how he could be a communicable person. So he did not stop having sex, for example. So he continued to spread what he didn't know he had, which was an immune deficiency virus.
Well, and some of for people of a certain age, it's difficult to communicate the sort of mass panic, because, you know, for what, half the people who are alive today, HIV and AIDS have always been part of the landscape. Mm-hmm. It's something they grew up in. But for people of a certain age, what a shockwave that was when the first reports of it came to roll out, and all of that. There weren't a whole lot of, you know, when the most amazing things were said about it, there weren't a whole lot of questions asked.
Right, and the first groups affected by HIV, what we came to know as HIV in America, were gay men, intravenous drug users, female sex workers, and Haitian immigrants.
Yes.
And in the Reagan 80s, I don't know that you could find a less politically powerful collection of folks who aren't. And then the reaction to for a lot of people is, like you hear on a lot of issues, you kind of deserve what you get. If you engage in certain behavior, then you might expect bad outcomes. And Schiltz, to the degree he agreed that the rising STD rates in the decade before AIDS emerged among gays furthered that narrative a bit, and that's where some of the other criticism comes from, is that he was a gay Uncle Tom, and that he furthered the idea that gays were a dangerous element in society. And he had tracked, through his earlier reporting, STD rates among gay men, and this gets to the question I mentioned earlier. What is the gay liberation movement about? Is it just being free to express yourself sexually any way you want, or is it about something more? And it was like a lot of liberation movements. It had its take its baby steps. It had to get up on its legs. And it, admittedly, in the 70s, it really was more about just free sex, you know, that you're free of fear of being put in jail. You can express yourself now with whomever you want. And that had, you know, that had to evolve into what we know today as a more sophisticated gay rights movement, which has to do with issues of, like I mentioned before, economic and social and cultural equality.
And inclusion,
right.
and all of that, and that's the other part of the book, I think, that is fascinating. When I made reference to the sort of Zelig-like quality that he had, you know, in retrospect, we can see the revolution, the movement for equal rights for gays, forming this kind of coherent narrative that brings us. But at the time, it was anything but that. It was a lot of angry and often scared people, you know, who were arguing frequently about what the best direction was, what, you know, what statements they should make, and who said, what kind of figure did he cut in those chaotic early days of the battle for equal rights for LGBTQ citizens?
I think a controversial one, not one that was universally accepted. I think women, for example, gay women, were frequently critical of Schultz because they were excluded a lot from his first few forays into certainly his first two books. The first mm-hmm. book about Harvey Milk and the second about AIDS were not really issues that dealt primarily with lesbian women. He did get into more of that in Conduct Unbecoming because gay women were disproportionately being drummed out of the military under the no-tolerance policy that existed in that era. And so he did get a chance to write about the experience of gay women more. But that's an example of where the criticism from feminist scholars and others is that, you know, there's no presence for women in any of his work, and that who appointed him to be spokesperson for all gay people when you're leaving out, for example, you're leaving out one whole gender of the discussion. Mm. There's little discussion, of course, in that area of transgender rights, but I think that his criticism, of the sexual freedom that was being practiced or pursued at that time is one that remains controversial. And it's not as if Randy, by the way, was this puritanical guy who never mm-hmm. – he went to the bathhouses when he was younger. He worked in a bathhouse when he was in college. He struggled with drugs and alcohol, so he – but he had come to some realizations probably sooner than some others and was applying that to his writing. And I think that won him some enemies along the way.
Well, and as I read it, and obviously you're the scholar, but much of his argument was less about, with the bathhouses, was less about this is just wrong, you know, morally wrong, you shouldn't be doing this, than it is, okay, right now this is killing people, and, mm-hmm. you know, until we can figure out how to keep it from killing people, we probably ought to shut these places down.
Right, and then he had criticism. I interviewed Dr. Mervyn Silverman, who was the San Francisco County Health Officer at the time, and Randy was critical of what they were doing in terms of they couldn't pull the trigger on condom distribution, for example. They couldn't get that far. Mm-hmm. They were just still in the age of posters and pamphlets about what was believed to be safe sex practices. Well, condoms ended up being, at that era, one of the ways that people could protect themselves from this disease. And, you know, the county health officer at one point said, I threw Randy out of the health department, banned him from the building because he was just so disruptive and so questioning of what they were trying to do. They were even one time they were trying to map all the number of cases of HIV in the county, and that very quickly led to a concern that there was going to be a quarantine of gay people in the community. And Randy was front and center on all of that. So even official sources had their problems with him. He said that Schultz came back to him. Silverman told me this, and that Schultz promised to basically at least give the company, give the county's line, give the government's line in his stories. And his positions, by the way, were more closely aligned with Mayor Feinstein at the period than they were with Silverman or others.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Andrew Stoner, the author of a new book, The Journalist of Castro Street, The Life of Randy Schultz. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. You said a few minutes ago that lesbians in particular had a problem, and the phrase you used was, you know, who are you to present yourself as the spokesman for all, you know, all gay people if you're... Did Schultz see himself that way, though? I mean, that seems to be an essential part of the confusion here.
Right. He would say, no, I'm not. I'm a journalist, and what I have to
offer... just happens to be gay.
Right. But and I discussed, there's a couple of scholars in the book discussing this take-me-to-your-leader approach that the mainstream media tends to adopt mm-hmm. when covering marginalized or minority cultures. And once they identify a source as someone who will talk about being gay... And you have to remember that you probably encountered this as a reporter, as I did. Not everybody would talk openly about their sexual orientation in those days. And so the take-me-to-your-leader approach ends up putting him out there on a point for everyone to see, and he becomes the spokesperson, even though he says he doesn't want to be. But I think on another level, though, that he enjoyed being the source, the go-to source.
Well, it helped him sell books, among
other things. Right, and one of the critics of him, Michelangelo Signorelli, points out that Schiltz fit well with mainstream media because he was not in any way offensive to people in the straight community. He could explain things in a way that didn't leave them offended but challenged. And the more radical gay or queer theorists or activists at the time were more in your face. If you think about ACT UP at the time was laying down, closing the Golden Gate Bridge. They were interrupting masses at Catholic churches all over the country. A much more in-your-face approach to the movement than what Schiltz was advocating. And, you know, the book, though I think his book in his favor takes on all of those, even the straight media and the entertainment world and gay leaders and the health community.
Well, that seems to be one of the big fault lines that in telling his life story, you are also telling in some ways the story of a movement, is that essential debate. And it's not just the debate and the movement over equal rights for gays, but as you point out, just about any other minority or disenfranchised group. You know, the question of, do we get ahead by pointing out the ways in which we are different, or pointing out the ways in which we are the same,
right,
as the dominant culture? Where did he fall on that debate?
I think that it was probably more of we integrate ourselves into how we're more of like everyone else than how we're different. I mean, if you look at early Mattachine Society protests outside the White House, the women were all required to wear dresses, the men wore neckties and jackets, and so they wanted to present themselves, gay people wanted to present themselves in that area as very much just like everyone else. And I think I don't know that this translates immediately, as some people say it does, that he was some self-hating person. I don't think that is what that means. I think his interpretation, though, was that we would get further, that we would advance more understanding if we were more like everyone else in terms of residing alongside of them and being included. And his integration into the newsroom, for example, is a classic example of that. Being in the newsroom, being present was important. And a lot of black reporters will tell you that in the same era, that breaking through was important, to be at least present and raise a question in a story meeting, or raise a particular different angle for our story than might have otherwise been thought. Because up in this period, gays are being dealt with as a problem perspective. You know, they're in the crime report, or they're in the State Department, you know, purging itself of homosexuals. So you have a real problem perspective built around what it means to be gay, and the media, that's how they deal with it, just as a problem. There's no positive aspect to that to be covered, and no.
Well, and that was, as you point out, in the military and the diplomatic service or whatever, being gay meant you were a security risk, basically, because you were subject to blackmail.
Right, and we have military members being sent to Leavenworth on prison sentences for being gay, and he documented quite a few of those in his book, Conduct Unbecoming. And they also had gay women in the military being threatened with losing their children if they were exposed to for being gay. So he was very concerned about that heavy-handed approach, but at the same time said, you know, I'm still interested in the story of gay people who want to serve the military, because there were a lot of gays that said, well, if you join the military, you deserve what you get. If you're that dumb, then, you know, you get what you get. His thought was, you should be allowed to serve in the military even though you're gay. It doesn't matter, and that this shouldn't be a barrier to your service. And so I think that to my point earlier, this integration of yourself into all aspects of society is normal and is what he viewed as the way the world should be.
In terms of how he arrived at that point, and we're going to be coming up on a break here in a second. I guess maybe we should just set this up. I'd like to talk a little bit about his evolution, too, because that's the other part that's fascinating, is he starts out as, a Barry Goldwater Republican, and then I'm not sure entirely where he fits in the political landscape by the time he dies. So, that is something I think we'll discuss in some depth about his political journey. when we come back from our break. We are talking today on No Limits with Andrew Stoner, who is the author of a new book, The Journalist of Castro Street, The Life of Randy Schultz. Schultz was the author of the books And the Band Played On and Conduct, Unbecoming, and a renowned journalist. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Andrew Stoner, who is the author of a new book, The Journalist of Castro Street, The Life of Randy Schultz. Schultz was, a controversial author and journalist in his time. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So I set things up beforehand. I wanted to talk a bit about Schultz's political evolution. And then the other part I'd like for you to talk about, because you talked about the guy's confidence in himself and his... I'd like to talk a little bit about where you think that came from, because, you know, in many ways he was not a particularly distinguished student in high school or until relatively late in his college career. And, you know, at least by his account, he'd suffered considerable amount of abuse in his childhood, and that often is not something that enhances one's confidence. So let's talk about how he became Randy Schultz, Randy Schultz we know anyway.
Right. To the issue of his confidence, I think some of that was probably correctly attributed to some false bravado, because his feelings could easily be hurt, very prideful. But he had grown up in a home where he tried very hard to be pleasing. He's one of five boys that were born over a 25-year period. And as he described it, you know, mom was home pretty much alone with the five boys for most of that time raising. Dad was around, and dad always provided, but there were quite a few dysfunctional issues related, and mom...
infidelities.
Yes, right, that sort of thing. And as he described it, his mother seemed to zero in some of that abuse on him. And I think it was because he was talkative. He was a very extroverted kind of kid, so he drew a lot of that toward himself. It's interesting, he had perfect attendance all through middle school or junior high school and high school, and his teachers, I'm sure, were impressed that he was such a dedicated student, but for him it was a way to get out of the house. If I go to school every day, I have at least this amount of my life that I can take away from the experience I have at home. His support of Barry Goldwater, for example, flows from that. His parents were vehemently opposed to the Vietnam War and to even as early as under President Kennedy, and certainly under President Johnson, were opposed to the war and wanted it ended. And they were more correctly described as libertarian than Republican, but for whatever reason, I think Goldwater's forthright way of saying things and bold statements kind of attracted them. And so Randy was part of Young Americans for Freedom in Illinois, for example, and worked on the Goldwater 64 campaign as a volunteer, and was very active in that sort of thing. But I think it flowed from opposition to the war. He was then attracted in high school very much to Robert Kennedy, mm-hmm. was very drawn to Kennedy's voice. And Kennedy was assassinated in Randy graduated high school on the one-year anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. He was very, I think, disillusioned with politics at that point.
Which would have put it about 50 years ago today.
Yeah, exactly. June of 1968. And he graduated June of 1969.
Yeah.
And he was very disillusioned with politics. And he had to go to Aurora College there in Aurora, Illinois for 1 year to get his grades up before he could go to Oregon, and hitchhiked across the country. And his story is very similar. All of the Schultz boys pretty much fled the house as soon as they were able to. They've been successful lawyers and professors and teachers and authors, in the case of Randy, journalists and authors. So they were very, somebody pointed out a lot of times children of alcoholics and children of abuse, some of them will work to overachieve as part of their pleasing process in terms of to win the affection that they need or to win the affirmation that they're missing. And so I think that's understandable. But underneath that can be a very thin veneer that where he was as partners. I've interviewed two of his partners. His romantic partners said he was very easily offended, hurt deeply by what people would say about him, and then would go to alcohol or marijuana. He was really a big aficionado of marijuana. He said he thought it was just the perfect thing for him, but he also learned it began to zap his ambition. So he eventually did get clean and sober.
So, we should talk. We've talked an awful lot about how he fit into his time. How would he fit into our time?
That's an interesting thing. I've thought that he would be a bit of a regular in terms of the talk media that we have now. And if you think of like cable television news, I think he'd be a regular there. Maybe a George Will type in terms of offering a lot of commentary books, about current events. I don't really see him being a newspaper journalist anymore. I really think of him more as an author. I think that's where he was headed. You know, they found in his last research before he died, he was interested in pursuing allegations of child sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, which if you think about the decade that followed from the 90s forward, that was just such a critical issue in America. So, I mean, if you think about this, he's there at the beginning of the gay rights movement. He's there at the beginning of the AIDS issue. He's there at the beginning of the whole discussion about the role of gays in the military. And then he wants to take up this next issue. He really was very adept at figuring out what's that next thing or what's the big issue under the surface that's rising that is going to dominate our discussion for the next several years. Would have been amazing to see, could he have done what the guys at the Philadelphia Inquirer eventually did, you know, in terms of uncovering a lot of that scandal and abuse.
Would he have, because you say it likely would not have been daily newspaper journalism, but at least a large part in your book makes this clear of his ability to find the pulse of the moment or whatever, is that he was out there all the time. I mean, he was talking to people. He was working the streets, working the phones, doing all the things that great reporters do. When you leave a newspaper, sometimes you get cut off from that kind of material. Would he have been able to survive without that kind of daily?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it may not have been completely necessary for him to leave because Chronicle was very supportive, and the Examiner also, their sister paper, very supportive of journalists. That one of the premier books, for example, on the Jim Jones crisis is by an Examiner reporter, and the Patty Hearst kidnapping story is very much a product of a Chronicle reporter who covered the subject. So they were very generous in letting reporters free to go pursue those kind of things and then keep them on the payroll, which is actually how Randy was able to live while writing these books. So it'd be interesting maybe he wouldn't have left at all. I wouldn't have had to, you know.
Did he ever think about leaving though it's after And the Band Played On, there were few more recognizable names in journalism at that time. And he was appearing on Nightline. You got to figure that there were any number of other papers, magazines, TV news programs that would have been glad to employ him.
Yeah, his literary assistant, Linda Alban, told me that his dream was to be a national columnist, to have a national column that he could do weekly or, every other week or something like that, where he was off the daily beat of reporting stories but could still do the essentials of journalism, collecting and reporting through a column and opinion pieces. She described it as, he'd be the gay George Will.
Okay, I'm trying to wrap my head around that.
Yeah. I don't know that you should draw anything in terms of being conservative. I think he still would be more progressive than a Will, but I think just that kind of settle into a senior spokesperson.
Well, and then end up being, with David Brinkley and all of that on This Week and that sort of stuff. So out of all of the research, what do you think is the main sort of lesson or whatever we should take from Schultz's life?
Well, what I hope people take from it is that we look at the totality of Randy Schultz, not just the mistakes and the controversy around patient zero and the things that he got wrong, but also how he advanced, truly advanced, the issues of gay rights, but also the inclusion of gays in the military and other aspects of society. I mean, when the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law was a policy, was eventually eliminated by President Obama in 2011, his name got mentioned by people as being responsible for helping call to attention the need to allow people to live their lives openly, that we should focus on the work that they do, the thing that they bring to the workplace, as opposed to who they are when they go home and who they love. And I think he should get some credit for that. I think a reconsideration of him is in order in that sense, because it takes a lot to shine light in those places before anybody else does.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Susan that's on point here. And again, if you want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Susan writes, Randy Schultz's book and the band played on was one of the first texts I read before joining the Damien Center in 1990. I recently recommended his book to the young LGBTQ and allies who now make up the Indianapolis men's and women's choruses we launched 30 years ago. Thankfully, they will not endure the suffering we witnessed in the early days of the HIV/AIDS pandemic.
Well, she certainly captures that correctly. The world, I teach undergraduates at Sacramento State University, and so I experience their world is very different than what I knew in college, and that someone is gay is kind of a so what thing to them, and that gay people are a part of the landscape, and it's an expected part of the landscape, and it's not a big deal. It wasn't always that way, and I think AIDS certainly complicated that considerably in the 80s, because you had not only something that you didn't want to, that you basically didn't want to set yourself apart in terms of your sexual orientation, but now you also are viewed as this sort of disease-carrying threat to the family and to everyone else. And I think it was a particularly difficult time, we're talking about, for to be gay and to be coming out. And I think that she captures well that the struggle is considerably less today. And I know there are those who don't think it should be, but I'm not one of those. I know that the progress ever forward is a good thing. I think he'd be pleased, by the way, to see how far we've come, but disappointed to know about, like, for example, we're still debating the role of transgender people in the military, which the arguments around that are the same as,
or whether they even should be allowed to use the restroom.
Right. I mean, the arguments around that are just the same as whether gays should even be there at all. So it's nothing new on that subject.
Do you think Schultz enjoyed being at the center of the storm?
Oh, very much so. I think so. And if you look at some of the things he said, some of the criticisms he launched at gay leaders, for example, I think he was more than happy to be take, as I say in the book, he could give as good as he got, depending on the subject. As someone pointed out to me, they thought he was a very angry man, and that I would have liked to have had time with him to discover whether that's in fact true. But they described him as an angry person, and some of that comes through. I certainly would acknowledge.
Gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Rosemary. And again, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Rosemary writes, I wish Randy's book could be rewritten with a correction about Patient Zero. The book is really an interesting look at how society regarded the AIDS epidemic and how, in some ways, gay men were not willing to step up and change their behavior after being warned by public health officials who told them to shut down the bathhouses, which encouraged promiscuity. Have there been any attempts to reissue the book with corrections? Is there any thought to that?
I'm not aware of that. I think that there is a book called The Making of Patient Zero by Richard McKay, and there's a documentary which I participated in called Killing Patient Zero that is exploring this whole particular issue. And so I think to that degree, to understand how it came to be and what's happened since, there's been some attempt in other sources. But I think that's the thing I always tell people if they're going to go back and look at And the Band Played On. I think you have to set aside a lot of the clinical discussion, for example, because it's very outdated, not just on patient zero, but on all sorts of aspects of AIDS in that period. A lot of the research is outdated. But the cultural, social, and political discussion in there is still point. It's on point. And that's where I think it holds up very well.
In terms of all of that, we talk about how things have changed, at least, it seemed that part of his argument also was that that gay people should be able to take more ownership of their own choices, including the bad ones that they make. I mean, one of the things I found moving is the stuff he's writing about, you know, his own alcohol. And, he says that he's addicted to marijuana, I think, at one point. I'm not sure that's medically possible. But, is that, one of the things you found appealing about?
Oh, definitely. I think that he's a amazingly honest guy in terms of himself, but also other people. And he says that. That's why he thinks he had an advantage on covering aspects of the story, that he wasn't going to be snowed by certain people who might, gay leaders were embarrassed by some of the things he would write about. They didn't like the fact that he would expose some of what went on. And, but then again, you also have political leaders. I talked to Cleve Jones, who was, very big in with Harvey Milk and part of the Names Project. Milk was very irritated with Randy Schiltz often because they didn't quite know what they were going to get sometimes. We're going to get a mainstream journalist who's going to question us on the basis of the gentrification of the Castro district, or we're going to get advocate for gay rights. So, he kept people off balance on purpose. And I think I mentioned to you before we started, and the old adage used to be the journalist knows they're doing a good job if everybody's mad, if everybody's pissed off at them. And he certainly fulfilled that on a lot of levels. But I think I hope I answered your question.
Oh, yeah. Well, and we're getting close to the end of the program here. So, but if people are still curious about this, you've got an event tonight, right, at Indy Reads. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. At 5 o'clock, we're at Indy Reads at 911 Mass Avenue. We'll have a reading, and the books will be available for sale. And there'll be a discussion, opportunity to ask questions if you'd like. And it benefits Indy Reads, which is a wonderful program here in the city that promotes literacy and reading.
What part of the book are you going to read? I'm curious. What part do you think is going to be?
I think that I have a standard presentation about Randy, and I think I'll read the preface because a lot of people tend to ask me, why did you write this or what motivated you? And so I want to get to why this is important and why it still matters to us. And so I'll read the preface and some of the introduction probably. It's a thick book, I had a good editor help me move it from dissertation to a trade book, so that it's got a wider readership than I think that it might have had otherwise.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guest, Andrew Stoner, the author of the new book, The Journalist of Castro Street, The Life of Randy Schiltz, for what has been an illuminating conversation about a still controversial figure in American history. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.